Shri Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to Shri Guru and Gauranga. All glorious to Shri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Vidlesha Maji Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivase Sasmiyani Paskatyade Sitarani. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Patkamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vipanishcha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So it's March 16, 2009 in Wellington at Gaura Yoga, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Dhruva Maharaja's Fight with the Yakshas. That's chapter 10, and we're on text 5, and we don't have the verse written up anywhere. Gachvoditim disamraja rudranu chadasevitam dadarsha himavadronyam purim guyakasam kulam. Gatva.
Gatva.
Going.
Going.
Udichim.
Udichim.
Northern.
Northern.
Disham.
Disham.
Direction.
Direction.
Raja.
Raja.
King Dhruva.
King Dhruva.
Rudra Anuchara.
Rudra Anuchara.
By followers of Rudra Lord Shiva.
By followers of Rudra Lord Shiva.
Sevitam.
Sevitam.
Inhabited.
Inhabited.
Dadarsha.
Dadarsha.
Saw.
Saw.
Himavat.
Himavat.
Himalayan. Jonyam,
Jonyam,
in a valley.
In a valley.
Purim,
Purim,
a city.
A city.
Guyaka,
Guyaka,
ghostly persons.
Ghostly persons.
Sankulam,
Sankulam,
full of.
Full
of. Guya also means something hidden or secret. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Dhruva Maharaj went to the northern direction of the Himalayan range. In that valley he saw a city full of ghostly persons who were followers of Lord Shiva. Purport. In this verse, it is stated that the Yakshas are more or less devotees of Lord Shiva. By this indication, the Yakshas may be taken to be the Himalayan tribes like the Tibetans. Gatvo dichim disamraja rudranu chadasevitam didarsha himavadronyam puringu yakasam kulam. So here the King Dhruva is going to the city of the Yakshas in order to try to get justice for his murdered brother. And, of course, he's coming there wanting them to surrender the murderer, and they don't do so, and there ends up being a battle with the Yakshas. So he's going there prepared to fight. And here we see that these Yakshas, which Prabhupada says are still existing as Himalayan persons, Himalayan tribes, that they're devotees of Lord Shiva. So recently I was giving a talk at an Ayurvedic yoga college in Auckland. I was explaining about the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. And some of the students there asked me, how did you decide to worship Lord Krishna? Why didn't you worship Shiva or Ganesh? And I thought, first of all, that that was a very odd question coming from a Westerner. Although I think probably nowadays that's not such an odd question coming from Krishna. And I said, when I first took up Krishna consciousness, I heard about it from Srila Prabhupada, and I really didn't know anything about Shiva or Ganesh or Durga. I wasn't coming from that tradition, and I didn't really come with that kind of knowledge, and I just took Srila Prabhupada's explanation. I didn't feel like I had a whole supermarket to choose from as far as what kind of Eastern path I was going to follow. I had done a lot of investigation of Western religions, but not of Eastern ones. So I did find that interesting. And certainly nowadays, people have become much more aware of the various paths given in the Vedas, one of which is the worship of Lord Shiva. And certainly many people who take up yoga, I would imagine a lot of people who come here, are very interested in Shiva. Especially I noticed you have your poster up for Kundalini Yoga at Gaura Haven. So Kundalini Yoga, I don't know how many of you really know a lot about Kundalini Yoga, but Kundalini Yoga is the meeting of Shiva and Shakti. You're trying to unite Shiva and Shakti. Just like when we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, who are we trying to unite? The Jiva with Krishna, definitely. And who else? Who's Hare? Radharani. So when we say Hare Krishna, who are we uniting? Radha and Krishna. Yes, which is the source of all spiritual bliss. As soon as you unite Radha and Krishna, or Sita and Ram, or Lakshmi and Narayan, because Radharani is the pleasure energy of the Lord. So when we say you want to please Krishna, we say our whole goal is to please Krishna. Pleasing Krishna means that Radharani is involved immediately because she's his pleasure energy. As soon as you say, I want to please Krishna, immediately you're talking about Radharani or Lakshmi or Sita. So our goal is to unite Radha and Krishna. But many people have the goal of uniting Shiva and Shakti. So I thought we'd look at this and say, how do we really decide who's God and who to worship? I suppose some people start from even deciding whether or not there is a God. You know, is there a God? Should I worship anybody? Should I have any kind of religious life? So maybe we could take a little bit of time with that, though not a whole lot. And then we can talk about who's God, how we decide who's God. Because obviously people worship different personalities thinking that they're God, or thinking that they're the Supreme, or thinking that a worship of this person is going to give them what they want. So is there a God? Well, I don't know. To me, that's a pretty simple thing. That's like saying, let's take something really simple, like the cushions that we're sitting on. Those are pretty simple things, right? They're not very complex. However, if I said to you, a one-year-old child made those, or even a two-year-old child, you probably would really wonder whether or not I was telling you the truth. Isn't it? Or if I said, you know, we have a factory of chimpanzees that manufacture these cushions, you definitely want to come and see the factory. So even though they're very, very simple, still we can understand that they're the product of intelligence. Now, what to speak if we take something more complex? We don't have it up right now, but just like there's a painting that's sometimes up in this room. Or, you know, yeah, you can see the Panchatattva. So if I said, well, this was just created again by some chimpanzees, you'd say, I don't think so. But somehow when we look at the flowers there on the side, people are going to say that this happened by chance. So again, to me, this is a pretty simple thing. If I can understand that a painting of a flower required intelligence, so certainly the real flower required intelligence. And intelligence, as soon as you say intelligence, then you're talking about some sort of personality. You're talking about something with desires, not just some force. There's also some other arguments for the existence of God, which are a little bit more complicated, but you might find this one fun. I don't know if you'll enjoy it or not. If you like logical puzzles, you might enjoy it. It's the ontological explanation for the existence of God. And if you're really interested in this, there's some nice websites where you can look up this particular argument. And basically, it works on that God must exist by definition. So if you say, thank you very much, if you say, what is God? What do we mean by God? And we say, well, God means a being greater than whom no being can exist. Or the greatest being is a simpler way of putting it, although that doesn't exactly give the same meaning. A being where you cannot imagine, you cannot conceive of any being greater than that. The greatest being that one can conceive of. So according to that definition, if God only exists in my mind, then he's not the greatest being. There's something greater. Something greater than something I can imagine is something that can exist. Therefore, if God is the greatest being that one can imagine, he must also exist. Now that's the ontological argument, or the argument from logic. But the basic argument from experience is anything we see, we can discriminate generally as to something that was created that was intelligently formed and something that was created just sort of by chance, right? That's what archaeologists do. They dig and they find a stone, And they say, is this just a stone or is this a stone arrowhead? Is it created by human beings? And sometimes they're not quite sure. But when we look at the things in this world, we can see many, many things which must require intelligence. Okay. Now, who is this God? What is the nature of God? So the first question would be, well, is it one or many? Because just like the things in this room, you know, this carpet was made by somebody who's intelligent, the curtains were made by someone who's intelligent, the projector screen, the heater, you know, but they were all different people, probably. It probably wasn't the same person who made the cushions and that wooden table, and it was a group of people. So perhaps everything was created by a group of people. But we do see that there's a certain amount of coordination, isn't it? There's certain repeating patterns in nature. I should memorize the name of this. I think it's called Fibonacci numbers. There's certain repeating numbers that happen in cells and in plants and animals. And one reason that people come to the conclusion of Darwinian evolution is that they see that there's sometimes similar patterns in different types of bodies. It's as if there was some sort of set of master plans and there were just variations made of those plans. So there's some kind of harmony. Now, in management, the most unstable form of management is a partnership, an equal partnership. So probably some of you know I have degrees in management. So generally, there has to be some chair. We used to call them chairman. Now we just call them the chair. You are the chair. You're the table, you're the chair, you're the pen. So usually there's somebody who's the chair. Our wonderful former president, George W. Bush, made this statement, I'm the decider. So there's someone who's ultimately the decider. If you have a group of people, often they can come to an agreement, but sometimes not. Sometimes not. There's generally some chief. So again, according to our experience, that even if there was a group, there would have to be a chief. Now, if we want to know something about the nature of God, which very much relates to this verse and purport and this idea of these particular persons worshiping Shiva rather than Krishna. So what is the nature of God? So if we're going to, again, define God as the greatest being, the being other than whom one cannot imagine anything greater. Yeah, I know it's a complicated way of saying things, but it's not quite the same as saying the greatest being. Well, then that being would have to be the greatest in any area where there is an absolute. Now, we often define Krishna as being the absolute in beauty, the absolute in knowledge, the absolute in strength, the absolute in renunciation, in wealth, in fame. But some of those things, according to logic, you really can't have a greatest. How can something be the greatest in beauty? In other words, you could always imagine something more beautiful, right? And in fact, Krishna's beauty is described as always expanding. It's not like he has a point, okay, now he's the most beautiful, and it sort of stops there. But his beauty is always increasing because beauty is the kind of quality that can always increase. Just like numbers, you can't say, okay, there's a biggest number. Can you conceive of a biggest number? No, because you can always add one more. So if we're going to say God is the greatest being that one can conceive of, one cannot conceive of anything greater, then you'd have to talk about greatness in terms of things that have an end. So one of those things would be justice. Perfect justice would be a being who always gives everybody exactly, not more or less, than what they deserve. That would be perfect justice. Does that make sense? And the greatest being would also have to be perfectly merciful, which is what we're really going to get into in this verse. And perfectly merciful, of course, is you don't always give everybody exactly what they deserve. Mm-hmm. In fact, you often give people less than what they deserve. So some people have argued that such a being cannot exist because those are two contradictory qualities. How can you be both perfectly just and perfectly merciful? Another quality of God is that he'd have to be omniscient. Now, he'd have to be all-knowing. Again, that's a quality that you can say. All-knowing is you know everything about everything there is to know. And again, one cannot conceive of a quality greater than that. That's an absolute quality. So, of course, Krishna is described as that, as knowing everything about everything that there is to know anything about. We also describe that Krishna himself, because he's always expanding, his knowledge of himself is also always expanding. And a perfect being would also have to be all-powerful, to have all powers that's possible to have. So Krishna is also described like that. So therefore, the greatest being must be just, but also merciful, must be kind, must be benevolent. When we think of greatness, we don't think of greatness just in terms of power, but we think of greatness in terms of power rightly used. I mean, somebody like a Hitler or a Stalin or an Italy, I mean, we can imagine someone greater than them. We would imagine a Mother Teresa to be greater than Hitler, wouldn't we? Isn't it? Although she had less power than he had, because she was benevolent. So how is God perfectly just and perfectly merciful? So this is our understanding of Radha Krishna, or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu there, with his hands like this. According to modern psychology, men understand morality through justice. Our Krishnaloka has this book in her room that I was starting to read about the differences in communication style between men and women. It's interesting because when I was a teenager, there was propaganda that men and women, other than the obvious physiological differences, were totally identical, and that the only difference in psychology or behavior was a result of conditioning and a result of upbringing, and that's no longer accepted by modern science. Anyway, so it's explaining the different communication styles of men and women. And also there's been a number of studies about how do people get a sense of morality. And the first studies were done just with university males. And the conclusion was that people develop their sense of morality through a sense of justice and fairness. And later on, a researcher named Gilligan said, hey, wait a minute, nobody involved women. And the same studies were done again with women, and the conclusion was that women came to a sense of morality through ideas of mercy. And we see this in the explanation of Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He's describing the qualities of Krishna, who of course has unlimited qualities, but he lists 54. And he says the quality of compassion is the person of Radharani. She is Krishna's compassion. She's made of compassion. So we understand God as being Radha Krishna. Krishna, who's perfectly just, he says, Eyatamam prapajante tam sataiva bhajamyaham. As you surrender to me, I reciprocate. He says, I'm seated as though neutral. I'm not responsible for people's pious and sinful activities. I'm detached, right? I'm just reciprocating. You do good things, you'll get good karma. You do bad things, you'll get bad karma. How you approach me, I'll reciprocate with you in the same way. That's perfect justice, but Radharani is just overflowing with compassion. Let me somehow bring everybody to enlightenment. Let me somehow or other bring everyone to spiritual love, whether or not they deserve it. And Prabhupada said, just like in this world, the psychology is if you ask a man for something, he may refuse, but if you convince his lady friend, she can convince him. Oh, please, can you do it for me? Right? So Radharani will go to Krishna. They're the same person. But she'll say to Krishna, please accept this person, even though they may not be qualified. Actually, they're more qualified than I am. And Krishna will say, yes, very, very good, no problem. And Radha and Krishna exist together in the form of Chaitanya. So Lord Chaitanya is Radha and Krishna. Therefore, in one person, perfect justice and perfect mercy. But this benevolence of God is not understood very well by souls like us who have come to this material world. We who have come to this material world, we are in rebellion against Krishna. Now, the main question that people ask is, well, if Krishna is really so perfect, why would anybody rebel against him? And that question, of course, it comes from a place of pride. The real question is, I wouldn't do anything so dumb. I would never leave a perfect situation. But if we think about it, even in this life, we've certainly made foolish decisions. I was just speaking to one lady a few days ago, and she and her husband are going through some difficulty. And she said, I think I would just want to leave him and be on my own. And he's a very wonderful person. And even she's saying, I'm probably making a mistake and I'll probably regret this the rest of my life. I said, yeah, I agree. I said, you may regret it for more than one life. But we do things like that. We have that ability. And you can say, well, if I knew everything, I wouldn't do it. And that's not necessarily true either. Do we sometimes do things that we know are not good for us? Right, anybody here only do 100% of the time things that you know are in your own best interest? Anybody? Okay. In fact, we're lucky if we go one entire day only doing the things that we know are in our best interest for 24 hours. You know, we'll do things that we think, I know this is bad for me, I know I don't like it, I know I don't want to do it, and yet we do it. Isn't that odd? I mean, isn't that strange? Yes. So just the fact that we have knowledge of something doesn't mean that necessarily we're always going to make the right choices. We have freedom. So we who are in this world, we have chosen to say, you know, I really don't like the way that God runs things. I think I could do a better job. And that mentality shows up all the time in relationship to anybody who's in a position of authority over us. This envy, we say, of God, this criticism of God. We tend to criticize anyone who's in a position of authority over us. We tend to find some way in which we don't have to follow that person, or we, you know, can follow them partially. I'll follow them in the areas I agree with them, and I won't follow them in the areas that I don't agree with them. And generally thinking, my son made a deal with me to read this book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He'd been trying to get me to read it for years and years and years and years and years. I never wanted to read it because my mother took the course, and after that, I didn't like the way she behaved after she took the course. And I said, I don't want to read the book. And he said, okay, Mom, I'll make a deal with you. I'll read an equal number of pages in any Krishna conscious book you want if you'll read the book. So I said, okay, we'll go with that. But anyway, Dale Carnegie was saying, whenever you're in a group of people, everyone in that group thinks that they're superior to you. So generally, we think like that. We think, I'm better than everybody. We find at least some way that we're better. We find some fault in everybody that we're around. You know, they don't dress neatly or something. You know, there's some area in which I can feel that I'm superior to them. So this is our general mood, and we have this mood ultimately with God, that we don't understand how he's all good, how he's all merciful, how he's all benevolent. And you find that even religious people, what are they doing? They're often praying to God, asking for things, asking for some change in their life or some change in the lives of people around them. And the mentality is often, not always, but the mentality is often, I know better than you how to run things. I know better than you how my life should be, and I know better than you how the lives of my family and friends should be. Look, let me tell you how to do things, please. You know, I really should have more money in the bank, and I really should have better health, and I should have a nicer husband, or I should have a husband, or whatever. Now, it's certainly better to ask God for things than to just try to do them independently without asking God. And if we have these desires, it's better to be honest about them and to go to God. But one can go to Krishna in the mood of, my dear Lord, I have this desire, and if you like, you please fulfill it. I'm dependent on you. That's a very nice mood. But to go to Krishna with the mood of, okay, these are the things that I want. And if I get them, then I'll believe in you and worship you. And if I don't get them, then I won't. And you see that many people who try to bring out faith in God, they do it through stories like that. Somebody's car breaks down on the side of the road. This is a true story. Their car breaks down on the side of the road. They're in the military, and they have to get back to camp on time, or they're going to be in trouble with the commander. And they look in the car, and they notice that a certain screw has fallen out of the engine, and it's a certain size screw. And here they are on the side of the motorway, and how are they going to get the right size screw in time? And one of the two soldiers is religious, and he starts praying, "Dear Lord, give me a screw." And then he goes to his buddy, and he said, "Okay, it's all taken care of." And then a truck, this is a true story, and a truck goes down the motorway, and as it goes down, something bounces out of the back of the truck. And lo and behold, it's the proper size screw. And of course, this sort of thing's happened many times. But that's many people's idea, and that's lovely, but that's many people's idea of what is religion. Religion is, I have some need, I have some problem, I ask God, he gives me exactly what I need. Well, there's a God. Right? And that can very easily be, it doesn't have to be, it can be the proper mentality, but it can very easily be the mentality, as Prabhupada said, God is my order supplier. Now, the word order supplier must be an old British term. I don't think we use it much anymore. But just like nowadays, you go on the internet and you order something. Right? Like I got this jumper online. I wanted, you know, something like this, and I go to different sites, and then I place my order. And then it better come in the mail. And it better be what I ordered. Or I'm not going to be very happy, and I send it back. So people often deal with God like that. And therefore, and they look at their lives and say, you know, I don't really think that God is benevolent. If he was benevolent, then my life wouldn't be the way it was. I would have gotten married earlier, or I would have married a different person, or I would have had kids, or I wouldn't have had kids, or I would have had more money, or my nose would have been a different shape, or, you know, I wouldn't have had an alcoholic mother, whatever it may be, you know. I wouldn't have this lousy boss. I wouldn't be living in the country with this climate I don't like. Whatever it may be about our lives, we're thinking, you know, how can God be benevolent if I have so much suffering? And there's various ways people try to deal with it, and one way that people deal with it is they look for someone else that they can call as God. They worship, try to worship some other being who's powerful, and Lord Shiva is one of those beings. Now, Lord Shiva is a very, how shall we say, unusual personality. He's not a little soul like us, and nor is he God. He's somewhere in between. He's almost God. Kind of like the difference between milk and yogurt, if you compare him to God. He's not quite God, but he's God at the same time. And he's in charge of the material nature. He's particularly in charge of ignorance and false ego. False ego is exactly this idea that I am the controller. I can decide what's best for me. I have more benevolence than the controller. So he's in charge of that idea. And it's interesting because there's a lot of aspects of Lord Shiva that remind us of Western concepts of a devil. You know, he's wearing bones and he has a trident and he has ghostly associates and hobgoblins associates, and he's in charge of the material world, and he's especially in charge of destruction. So wars, sickness, basically all the suffering, that's his jurisdiction. That's what he takes care of. But he's not an evil being. In fact, he's a great devotee. He's a great realized personality who's doing a particular job. So Arvindasru Prabhu says that our Vedic philosophy is the only philosophy that integrates this idea of God and the devil. We don't think there's some evil being who's a competitor with God. but there's a being who runs the material world. And Lord Shiva has the nature, as running the material world, that he easily gives the kind of benedictions that people ask for. If you say, you know, I want more money, I want the right screw for my car, I want a handsome husband, I want the right job, he's more likely to just give it to you. And he's likely to give it to you without considering whether or not it's good for you. It's like some sort of very indulgent parent, that anything the children ask for, he just gives. And Lord Shiva is also, is typical for indulgent parents, the psychology of indulgent parents, is they give and give and give to their children, and then if their children do something wrong, they also get very angry. We could discuss that, but that's a lengthy discussion. Why those two things tend to go together, why parents who are very indulgent also periodically get very angry with their children. But Lord Shiva is also like that. And if someone who worships him does something that displeases him, he may just also curse them very easily. His consideration is not the ultimate welfare of the person who is petitioning him. We find this is true often with modern governments. Modern governments often have programs meant to benefit the citizens that end up harming the citizens. It's quite common for this to happen, just like the whole, what we call in America, welfare. What do you call it here? The dole. So, you know, not that long ago, governments were not in the business of doing that. That sort of help was given on a local level, especially by religious organizations. People gave in charity to the local religious organization, and then they gave in charity to the needy people, which, of course, is also the Vedic system, that the government gives in charity to the Brahmanas or the religious people, and they then distribute that charity. And one benefit of having charity distributed, first of all, by religious saintly persons, and second of all, on a local level, is that the charity is given where it's actually needed and where it will do good. And when charity is given out by government officials and charity is given out on a broader level where the government doesn't really know the situations of the people. I mean, they try to have it locally administered, but their rules for giving it out, even the people locally administering it, they have to follow just a set of bureaucratic rules. And it ends up, I'm sure that all of us know of somebody who's on the dole that really shouldn't be. I'm sure you know of at least one person like that. They're getting some kind of disability payments, and you see, well, that's a perfectly abled person who's putting in maybe 30, 40, 50 hours of work at what they want to do, and yet the government is supporting them, isn't it? And the other thing that happened because of this increase in government support, which was meant to help people, is it's encouraged irresponsibility. And this is a big topic of discussion in America, I assume in a country like this also, that it's not some kind of accident that there's been a great rise in divorce and a great rise in just abandonment of women and children since the government had this policy. That previously a man thought, if I don't take care of my wife and children, they're going to be destitute. And even if he didn't like his wife and children very much, generally he didn't hate them so much that he wanted them, you know, going out of garbage bins in the street. Plus being a social outcast. I mean, you have to hate your wife and kids pretty much to be willing to do that to them. And there's not very many men in that category. But if you think, hey, you know, if I leave my wife and kids, then they can always just go on the dole. They'll be taken care of. No problem. So it really encourages irresponsibility. So we find this is also true even with a person like Lord Shiva, that he gives benedictions without considering. Is the result of this benediction going to be something helpful? Is it really going to bring benefits to the people to whom I give them? And there's many stories in the scriptures. The one given in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam is of this one person who was worshipping Lord Shiva, and his idea was that he wanted to become immortal by killing everybody else. And you might say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Even if I killed everybody else, I'd still die. But we generally have this mentality in the sense that I often try to make myself look good by putting other people down. I think if I criticize other people, then I'll look better. You ever seen this tendency? Maybe in somebody else, if not yourself. Right? And it's just as illogical. No matter how stupid everybody else is, doesn't make me any smarter. Right? So just the fact that everybody else would die wouldn't make him live any longer, but that was how he was thinking. And he also made up his own form of worship. He decided you're supposed to offer things like grains into the sacrificial fire. But he thought, let me offer pieces of my own body. That'll be a better sacrifice. So that's a little side lesson that you should ask somebody what they want, not just decide that you are going to offer them something better. So he was cutting off pieces of his body and throwing them into the fire. And he did that for about a week, and Lord Shiva didn't show up. And Prabhupada comments there, he said, when people worship Krishna, they're confident that Krishna is accepting the offering. They don't need him to show up personally and say, I've accepted it. But this particular person, Vrika, he said, I want Lord Shiva to show up personally. And he thought, all right, instead of just offering, little bits from my arm, I'm going to offer my whole head. So he was about to cut off his head and put it in the fire. Wasn't a particularly smart guy. And Lord Shiva said, I don't want this guy to commit suicide. So he came there, and somebody might say, well, he must be a very great personality if Shiva personally appeared before him. If someone came up to you and said, I personally talked to Lord Shiva yesterday, you might think, whoa. And when Prabhupada explains that anybody would want to stop someone who's committing suicide. But that doesn't, if you see somebody about to cut off their head and you try to stop them, it doesn't mean that you have some special love for them. It's just a normal thing to do. So Lord Shiva said, stop, I'll do whatever you want, just stop. And he said, okay, give me the power to kill anybody by touching their head. I guess he never thought that he wouldn't be able to comb his hair anymore. And Lord Shiva thought, oh no, what have I done? I told him he could have whatever he wanted. He said, well, I'm not going to go back on my word. Okay, you can have whatever you want. And then the demon said, all right, I'm going to touch your head. I'll start with you. I'll kill you and kidnap your wife. Krishna saved him from that problem. But the point is that Lord Shiva gave this benediction without checking first. To just say to somebody, okay, you can have whatever you want, without doing a little check about that, especially if you have the power to do that, without doing a little check of the person's psychology. some guest walks in the door and Krishnaloka isn't just going to say, hey, just like do whatever you want. She's going to get to know the person first before she gives some sort of carte blanche like that. So that's Lord Shiva's mood. But Krishna's mood is not like that. And because Krishna's mood is not like that, therefore, we often think that he's not really benevolent. Because I can't see the results of what I'm asking for. And again, we all have experience of this, that we think something is going to be beneficial for us. And it's not. It doesn't work out the way that we wanted. We think if I live in this place, I do this job, everything will be perfect. I'm just thinking about a friend of mine who wanted to buy a house in India, in a holy place in India. Really, 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 really wanted to buy a house in this holy place and thought, if I buy a house in this holy place, all my desires will be fulfilled. And in a country like India, there's not much government control over contractors and building codes and that kind of thing. Things work on the basis of bribes, and there's a lot of cheating. Obviously there's cheating goes on in New Zealand too, but not at that level. So my friend was stuck with a house where the walls were crying, and the paint was peeling, and the drains didn't work, and nothing worked. And kept going back to the contractors. Oh, yes, we'll fix it, and not fixing it, and not fixing it, and not fixing it. And the very house that this person thought would be the source of their happiness was the source of their great distress. Isn't it? Or someone thinks, you know, I'm going to make a business investment, and they put all their money into some business and it fails. So we don't always know what's best for us, and we don't always know what's bad for us either. Sometimes we're avoiding something, thinking, oh, I'll suffer so much if we do that, and we find that when we do it, it ends up to be wonderful. We think, why was I avoiding this for so long? So one a way of understanding God is that he knows what's really beneficial. And Krishna gives what's truly beneficial for those who worship him. Which means that he doesn't always reciprocate with us from our material point of view exactly the way that we would like. And this trust that what is happening to me is, number one, being controlled by somebody, and number two, that somebody is absolutely beneficial. When we have that full faith in our heart, not intellectually, when we really feel that, then we come to our natural position of spiritual enlightenment and bliss. That solves the problem which has put us into ignorance and illusion, which was basically thinking, I know better than the Supreme. So therefore we find that in the prayers of Brahma, in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto, he says, Tate Nukampan, one who accepts whatever happens in his life as the mercy and the kindness of the Lord, that person inherits the kingdom of God just like a child naturally inherits the father's property just by living. So you could say, well, do you just have to accept that blindly? Just have to say, okay, whatever happens to me is beneficial. Because it certainly doesn't seem like that. No, it's a gradual progression of faith. That you start saying, all right, let me take as an assumption, a logical assumption, that there must be a God. And for that God to be God, by definition, for that God to be a being greater than which no being can be conceived, that being must be absolutely merciful, must be absolutely kind, must be absolutely beneficent, must be as kind and beneficent as it's possible to be. And that being must also have all the powers that it's possible to have. Now, if I have a being that's all-powerful and all-kind, which is what Krishna says he is, Bhoktaram Yagatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Suridam Sarvabhutanam, he says, I am the Maheshwara, I am the supreme controller, and Suridam, Ridam means heart, Su means very, like very, or especially good, the heartfelt friend, Sarvabhutanam of all living entities. I take that as some, okay, if that's logical, then everything that's happening to me must be good. Especially once I decide to cooperate with that being. And if you had, and you'll never have, but if you had an absolutely beneficent government, unless it's run by God himself, which I suppose sometimes happens, like when Lord Ramachandra is here, but if you had an absolutely beneficent government, then even the prisoners would be existing in the prison house out of the kindness of a government for the benefit of the prisoners. But the prisoners wouldn't be experiencing that in a very positive way. But if you decide to be a good citizen, then certainly if you have a perfectly kind government, then everything that's happening to you would be good. Does that make sense? So if I'm in rebellion against God, everything's good in an ultimate sense. You know, if I'm a criminal in the prison, the existence of the prison and my punishment is good in an ultimate sense. It's good to reform me. It's good for society. But if I'm a free citizen, certainly everything that's happening to me is good if I have a proper government, if I had an absolutely good government. So once we put ourselves under the under the care of God personally. Once we say, okay, I'm going to cooperate with you, I've decided, at least in theory, that you're all-powerful and all-good, then whatever happens is for our benefit. And in the long run, we will see it like that. You see this kind of thing happen sometimes with, say, someone who wants to learn a sport and goes to a tough coach, or somebody who wants to learn some academic thing and goes to a teacher who's very demanding of high quality. And there's often books and movies made of people like that. You know, the tough teacher or the tough coach who turns around the difficult team or the difficult students, right? And usually those people are portrayed as having tough love, as really caring, but often exhibiting their caring through demanding high standards and not tolerating anything else but high standards. I was just speaking to a teacher the other day who was showing off some of the work of his students. And I said, there's a lot of grammar mistakes in this work. And it was finished work. It was in a booklet with illustrations, and these were like 12-year-old kids. I said, the grammar here is terrible. And the teacher said, oh, I don't really get the time to check their work. So in the long run, you appreciate that. If you have a teacher who you turn in the work and the teacher says, hey, this is not good, fix it. And you turn it back in, this is still not good, fix it. This is still not good, fix it. And they won't accept it until it's perfect, until it's the best you could possibly do. What's the result of that? You're going to achieve your goal. Oh, if you have some tennis coach who lets you hit the ball the wrong way, you know, you may end up getting an injury, and you're certainly not going to end up to be an Olympic tennis player, right? But if somebody says, hey, move, no, you got to move your arm this way, no, that way, still not right. Now, of course, a good coach and a good teacher is also going to tell you when you're doing it right. They're not only going to tell you when you're doing it wrong, but they're going to do both. So the things in our life are meant to bring us to ultimate happiness. Especially once we say, my dear Lord, you know, I'm really tired of materialistic life. I don't like it. I'm just, it's stupid, it's useless, it's boring, it's painful. I don't like it. I want something else. I want spiritual life. I want you. He said, okay, you're on board now. Let's get to work. And, you know, some of the things are not going to be materially pleasing. Being corrected is not pleasing. Another thing Dale Carnegie said in that book is no one ever wants to admit that they're wrong, ever, to anyone. And notice next time that somebody tells you you've done something wrong, and especially if it's something that you really have to look at and say it was wrong, and how do you feel? Pay attention to how you feel. You feel kind of yucky. It's hard to get the words out of your mouth and say, yes, I did something wrong, and mean it, not just to say that so that the person will leave you alone. It's a very difficult thing to do. Some people practically never do it in their lives. So there's some pain when we submit ourselves. Okay, help me, I want to be enlightened. I don't want to be a materialistic consciousness anymore. There'll be some things that feel very uncomfortable. And there'll be a lot of things that we don't understand. Why is this happening in my life? How is this really beneficial? But as you start to accept it intellectually, and gradually you'll start to see that things are actually beneficial. And therefore we can say that the personality of Krishna, who only gives what's beneficial for the worshippers, is factually the Supreme God and no one else. That other persons who are put forward, that this person might be God, this person might be God, this person, of course Krishna has many different names and is understood differently in different cultures or in different religions. But any other personality who's not totally beneficial for the worshippers cannot be the Supreme God. They may be a powerful personality, but they cannot be the Supreme God. And how do you judge whether or not something is ultimately beneficial? By the end result, not by the process. How do you judge whether you really have a good teacher, you know, if you want to learn writing? Are you a good writer when you finished? Not whether or not they put red marks on your paper. Many people think like that nowadays, I know, from being a teacher. Your parents will criticize you. Why are you putting so many red marks on my child's paper? They will. Why are you telling my child they have to get their homework done? This is very common. That they think a really kind and good teacher is going to be someone who just says, oh, it's so nice. Even if it's not. So you judge by the result. And to do that, for us as individuals, to some extent we can look at people who have graduated or who almost have graduated and see, are they achieving enlightenment? I mean, how do I decide if I want to learn tennis? How do I decide what tennis coach to sign up with? Well, how do his students perform, isn't it? When they're going to hire a coach for a football team. They look at, has he had a winning season with the other teams, isn't it? What kind of results does he get? They don't see, well, is he really nice and kind to all the players? They see, do his players win? So you want to look at people who've really stuck to this process of Krishna consciousness. Are they becoming enlightened? Are they becoming full of happiness? Are they becoming full of knowledge? If you say to them, are you happy with how Krishna's dealt with you? Do you see that he's been all beneficial? What do they say? And ultimately, we have to look at ourselves and see, when I take up this process, am I starting to achieve some clarity of vision? Am I starting to see the truth, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita? You should approach a spiritual master because tattva darshan, he's seeing the truth. Am I starting to see the truth? I mean, I found myself that after a very short time of practicing Krishna consciousness, I started to see the world in a very different way. It was as if, I felt as if I had had bad eyesight and not known about it and all of a sudden put on a pair of glasses. You know, when you get old, your short-range vision goes, but after a while, your long-range vision starts to get a little fuzzy too. And I didn't even really know that my long-range vision was going bad. And anyway, this, I don't like to wear these all the time because I can see well enough at a distance to manage. But when I put these on, boy, all of a sudden you all get a lot sharper. All of a sudden everything's more defined. So it's like that. You know, you start chanting Hare Krishna, you start reading the books, and all of a sudden things start becoming defined. You say, like that. And that's just for a beginner. And the ultimate, of course, like we read about Dhruva Maharaj previously. So he was following not exactly the same way we're following this process, but he was following the process of bhakti yoga, chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, worshipping the deity, etc. And when he actually saw the Lord, when he became perfect, it's explained that it felt like he woke up. Felt like, oh, now I'm awake, now I'm aware. And before I was in a dreaming condition. So this is also our test. And if this sort of thing is happening to us, even at a beginning level, not that we should expect that after one day or 2 days or even 2 years, we're going to become a fully enlightened being, although it's possible. It's rare it will happen that fast. And the main reason it won't happen that fast is because we're generally not willing to let it happen that fast. It'd be too much. If you told the 6-year-old everything that was wrong with their paper, they would just cry. You usually have to take it slowly. But still, we should see some progression towards enlightenment. And to trust, therefore, that what is happening to us, whether apparently materially wonderful or apparently materially horrible, is all beneficial. Whereas the benedictions given by persons by Lord Shiva, rather than leading to enlightenment, they lead to further illusion. So Lord Shiva will give things like wealth and beauty and this and that, and which simply illusions persons. Whereas if Krishna gives such benedictions to a person, he makes sure that it will not illusion them. So this is one of the bases on which we decide that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right? So we have, I'm supposed to be there at 9 today instead of 10. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes?
If Krishna gives us something, how do we know whether it's going to be Krishna or from our own mind or our own kind of stubbornness?
If Krishna is the supreme controller, then everything that happens to us is under his direction. If we are a materially conditioned soul, then all of the suffering is due to our own choice. Both true. So let's say that you make a choice to shoot heroin. And because of your choosing to shoot heroin, you become an addict. Then you decide you're going to choose to go to a treatment program and get free of your addiction. So the treatment program will involve some things which feel to you like suffering. The process of getting free from your addiction will not be all entirely pleasant because your body's become accustomed to this drug. So the unpleasant things that are part of the treatment, they are a result of two things. They're a result of the expert physician, and they're a result of the fact that you became an addict in the first place. So all of our suffering is due to the fact that we rebelled against Krishna in the first place, and that we may still be rebelling against him to some extent at the present moment. And it's a result of him trying to help us get free of that. Those two things, both. There'd be no need for something experienced as suffering if we never put ourselves under illusion. Does that make sense? If I eat something, if I eat something that's poisonous and makes me sick and the doctor has to give me something to vomit, I mean, vomiting is not a pleasant thing. Anybody ever enjoy vomiting? It's horrible. So what's the cause of my vomiting? The doctor's healing medicine and the fact that I took some poison, both. If I never took poison, I would never have to be given some vomit medicine. So for those souls who have never rebelled, who have always been in harmony with truth, who've never looked for falsity, maya or illusion means that which is not. We look for falsity. We wanted falsity. And I'd say, put that in the past tense, but I'd say even now, all of us to some extent still want falsity. So to those who are always happy to be in harmony with truth, no vomiting is required. Okay? Now, if you haven't put yourself under the care of Krishna, if you're just going around, shooting heroin all the time, and you haven't put yourself under a treatment center, still, he's in charge of everything, but what's happening to you is more really your business. Does that make sense? No? Okay. So I'm choosing to do something that's hurting me, and I'm not going in for any kind of treatment. The hurt I'm experiencing is not exactly engineered by Krishna. It's engineered by Krishna in the sense that he's made my body to work in such a way that heroin hurts it. So in that case, in that respect, you could say that he's responsible. And there are people who find pleasure, for example, in cutting their body. So if the way I find happiness is taking a knife and cutting up my arm, the pain that comes from cutting my arm is Krishna's responsibility only in the sense that he designed the body not to be cut. And I'm going against that design. Now, a car manufacturer designs the car to work in a specific way. If I use the car in a way other than it's designed, you could say that the suffering that ensues is the fault of the car manufacturer for designing it in a particular way. To that extent, you could say that. But the car manufacturer gives you instructions. This is how it's supposed to be used. And if I intentionally violate those instructions, the responsibility for the suffering is entirely mine. Now, after misusing my car, if I take it into the dealer and the dealer says you have to pay me $200 to fix the car, now that pain of paying the $200 is both the responsibility of the mechanic and mine. I'm still suffering because I misused the car. All right? But that suffering of paying of the $200 is engineered by the mechanic for my benefit. In a larger sense, you could say that the car company engineered the car to work in a certain way also for your benefit. So Krishna's designed this body to work in a certain way also for our benefit. So also you could say the pain that happens when we violate that is also ultimately Krishna's kindness, but it's a little different. So the suffering of somebody who's not intentionally trying to work in accord with truth and the suffering of someone who's trying to work in accord with truth are a little different. Does that make sense? So, you know, there's this book stand. It's designed to hold a book. And the person who designed it to benefit me. It wasn't designed to hurt me. Now, if I take this and I start hitting myself over the head with it, is that the fault of the person who designed it? No. I mean, there are things that I should put on, like a hairbrush is designed, you know, but if I say, okay, I'm going to start brushing my hair with this thing, then I will experience pain. Is that the fault of the designer or is that my fault? It's my fault entirely. Although you could say that it's also the fault of the designer. They should have designed it to do whatever I wanted to do with it. So the designer is somewhat involved with that. And Krishna's designed the material world to work in such a way as to bring us to real happiness. He's rigged the material world so that it favors the mode of goodness. So that the closer you are to truth and the closer you are to reality, the happier you are. That's how he's designed things. And the more you're in falsity and the more you're out of harmony, you can see this with the environment. We thought, you know, we are going to enjoy, and I don't know if you're old enough to relate to this, but when I was growing up, ecology was a bad word. Science and technology were going to save everything. This is very hard for people nowadays to understand this, but it was really and truly like that. Pollution? Oh, that's a small price you have to pay for all the advancement of society. There was a television show, Star Trek, where they would show that traveled in outer space and the computer synthesized food. And you don't have a garden on your spaceship, you know. And the computer created synthetic food. And we thought this was great. We were all looking forward to the day when we travel in, what was it called, the Enterprise Starship, eating synthetic food. You know, the idea that science could give you a little pill and you poured water on it and it would expand into a synthetic meal, that would be, wow. That would be great. We thought antibiotics were wonderful. Seriously, I'm not at all joking. I mean, when I was a teenager, and I guess when I was about 14 or 15, and I would go on protest demonstrations in favor of the environment, that was considered politically subversive. There was nothing in the schools about the ecology and the environment. There were no government programs to help the environment. There was nothing like that. And, you know, what did we discover? Lo and behold, we discovered that if you do something wonderful that's not in harmony with the earth, you suffer. So that the whole universe is rigged like that. If you try to find happiness that's out of harmony with truth, you suffer. And if you do something that's in harmony with truth, the closer and closer and closer you get to harmony, and ultimate harmony, of course, is called yoga. Yoga is total, 100% harmony. So the closer that I get to harmony and real yoga, the happier I am. And the further away I get from it, the more I suffer. So in that sense, you can say that somebody who's not made a conscious decision to be in harmony with truth, that their suffering is engineered by Krishna. Because that's just how things work. But once you've made that conscious decision, once you say, I am going to live in harmony with truth. We also call Krishna the absolute truth. I want to achieve yoga. I want to achieve absolute 100% harmonious truth. Once you've made that decision, then you go on Krishna's training program. Once you sign up for the training program, especially once you officially enroll in the training program, if you're just kind of checking it out and coming, even then you start being under Krishna's. He starts looking out for you. But especially once you officially enroll and say, okay, I make a commitment, I'm going to dedicate my life to truth. I'm going to take vows that I'm going to live my life in accord with truth. Then he says, okay, let's get to work. And then everything we're suffering is a combination of our own nonsense, which causes us to be out of harmony in the first place, and the training program to get us back into harmony. Is that clear? And how do you know? You start getting back in harmony. That's your test. How do you know my doctor, my teacher, my coach is actually beneficial? You start feeling more in harmony. You start seeing truth. You start living in truth. You should directly perceive it. It shouldn't be a question of someone else making propaganda. Now you're supposed to be seeing truth. You should see it. Like if I'm drinking this herbal tea you gave me, I don't have to say to you, am I drinking it? I don't need to be convinced by some kind of groupthink. We all believe this, and you better believe this, you know? Like sometimes people say we're a cult. That's what a cult's like, you know? You have to believe this because we're telling you to. You try it. Say, yeah, it's warm. Feels warm. Makes my throat feel better. Is it working? All right? Am I feeling lighter? Am I feeling freer? And if you're not, then you can say, now, am I applying the process properly? You know, check that. And if you're applying the process properly and it's not working, then it's not the right process. It's pretty simple. Prabhupada says if you're eating and you're not feeling nourishment and strength, and either you're not really eating, like chewing gum, you know, you're up here to go through the motions, or you have parasites. Right? And you're eating, but everything's being stolen. So if you say, I'm in a process of truth, and you're not experiencing truth, then either you're not in a process of truth, or you're not applying it properly. You're lighting the fire with one hand and pouring water on the fire with the other. So anything else? Yes? Who doesn't pay taxes in America?
People in America.
The people in America don't pay taxes?
Yeah, and that's why they say, the business say, did anyone else hear that? And that's why they say,
well, somebody must be.
Do your business.
Somebody must be paying taxes in America.
Yeah, because you say you don't pay wealth, you don't have to pay taxes, and therefore
There's not as much. There's lower taxes because it's not as much welfare. But there's definitely welfare in America.
Okay, there is welfare.
Oh, absolutely. There certainly is. It's not to the extent, for example, in America, there's not free medical care.
Right, that's what he was saying.
Okay. Yes. And if there was free medical care, yes, the taxes would be a lot higher.
Okay.
So there's not as much, there's not as extensive a social welfare program in America as there is in probably in New Zealand or in the UK or in Sweden, but it certainly is there. And it's expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding. But definitely people pay taxes in America. Definitely. They definitely do. Anything else? Yes?
We were discussing yesterday, but we didn't really know, and it was about if there's a discussion in ISKCON whether ladies can take up disciples or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And if you could turn up.
Can ladies take up disciples? So, do you want me to give you the scriptural answer, the political answer, or both? Both. Okay. The political answer now, as in for the last month, is yes. So in 2004, the GBC said yes in theory, but don't do it. And which was an attempt to pacify everybody. If I say yes, it's okay in theory, then you pacify the people that want it. If I say no, you can't do it in practice, you pacify the people who don't want it. So there was a resolution put forward to the GBC this year. They said, all right, in theory, we'll decide later whether or not you can do it. So there was a resolution that, would you please decide? And so this year the GBC said, yes, it can be done. As far as traditionally, there's always been women who've had disciples. And even now in other branches of our tradition, there are women who have disciples. Is that okay? Guru has nothing to do with anything material. Some services we do for Krishna have something to do with something material. Like, I wouldn't ask a 5-year-old child to drive a car. Even if it was a self-realized, fully enlightened 5-year-old, I wouldn't ask them to drive a car. So, some things are going to depend on what kind of body you have and what kind of mind you have. I don't think the men are going to start giving birth and breastfeeding anytime soon. So there's going to be some differences according to the body and some differences according to psychology. You know, don't start asking me to paint paintings to illustrate the books. You know, I have some artistic talent, but not like that. You know, we each have different talents, we have different abilities, so even our service to Krishna, even our engagement in transcendence is going to be to some extent determined by what kind of body we have. Of course, there are certain things then that are not. One of them is chanting Hare Krishna. Everybody can chant Hare Krishna. For those of you who read Back to God, and even deaf people can chant Hare Krishna. If you read my article about my chanting Hare Krishna with deaf people. Silent chanting. So anybody can chant Hare Krishna, anybody can worship Krishna, anybody can think about Krishna. And being a guru is dependent on whether or not you are Brahmanistam, whether you are fixed in truth, not other things. So I find it peculiar, I know the reason for it, but I still find it peculiar that we tend to have this non-discriminatory view of guru in regard to everything but gender. I mean, we so much preach you don't have to be Indian. None of you are Indian. Some places I go, everybody's Indian. You know, but we definitely say, you know, you don't have to be Indian in order to be enlightened. And that may sound silly to all of us here, but it doesn't sound silly to a lot of people who are Indian. And doesn't sound silly to a lot of Westerners. There's a lot of Westerners who think in order to find an enlightened person, it's got to be an Indian. Seriously. We say you don't have to be born in a particular family. You don't have to be born in a family of priests. Now again, that seems kind of silly to us, but it doesn't seem silly to the priestly families. We say you don't have to be from a particular race. You don't have to be white or black or Chinese or, you know, we've been practicing that for a long time and preaching that, but somehow the issue of gender we didn't quite get. And I think one reason is that although Srila Prabhupada does say in a number of places that it doesn't matter black, white, Indian, American, European, man, woman, often he doesn't have gender in his list. So often his list will be, it just doesn't matter whether you're Indian or European, for example. But, you know, he doesn't generally have New Zealanders in his list either. They'll say, you know, to become an enlightened person, it doesn't matter whether you're an Indian or a European or an American. And you might think, oh, so, you know, if I'm Japanese, I'm like out of the picture. But just because he didn't mention every nationality and every ethnicity. And Prabhupada didn't always mention gender, but he certainly did on several occasions. So enlightenment doesn't depend on what kind of body you have. Actually, you know, even if you're an animal, you can become enlightened. Hanuman's an animal. We wouldn't mind having Hanuman as our guru. Right?
And there's a difference between Shiksha Guru and Diksha Guru as well.
Actually, you're not going to like this. It says in the Shastra that if you think there's a difference between Shiksha and Diksha Guru, you commit an offense in devotional service. There's a difference in function. It says that one should not discriminate seeing a difference between Diksha and Shiksha Guru. Unfortunately, for various reasons, in ISKCON, there's generally perceived to be a huge difference between Shiksha and Diksha Guru, but that's not Shastric. Sorry. And not only is it not Shastric, but it says in the Shastra that if you do that, you're committing an offense in devotional service. So there's a difference in function. And interestingly enough, in our tradition and in our line, who's more important? The Shiksha Guru. If you look, like in Bhagavad Gita, there's a list given. This list came from Bhakti Siddhanta. Anyway, I don't know what page it's on. I think it's in the introduction. There's a list given of our parampara. In a number of those cases, you're looking at Shiksha Guru, not Diksha Guru. The Diksha Guru is not listed. And if you took our Diksha Guru list, we'd go back through Janava Devi. It would be a very, very different list if it was a Diksha list. So our parampara, and we're criticized for this, by the way. There are groups who criticize us and say that we're not a bona fide organization because we consider our line more through Shiksha than through Diksha. And there's groups of people who are very critical of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati for that. And what Prabhupada says is that generally the Shiksha Guru later on becomes the Diksha Guru, generally. So it's a difference in function. Prabhupada explains just like a school. You know, you attend classes, but at a certain point you enroll. So there's an admissions officer. There's somebody who says, yes, I certify that you can be an official student in the institution. That's Diksha. And it's possible for a Diksha Guru to only give Diksha and have the Shiksha that they give. The Diksha Guru is obligated to give a certain amount of Shiksha. The Diksha Guru has to give at least Shiksha on what mantras to chant and how to chant the mantras. And ideally, the Diksha Guru should also give you some Shiksha on the meaning of the mantras, although we find that Gopakumar's Diksha Guru and Brihad Bhagavatamrita did not do so for quite a long time. So that's the only obligation of the Diksha Guru. Now, the Diksha Guru may also be your primary Shiksha Guru. It doesn't have to be. And there should only be one Diksha Guru. You should never get the same mantra twice from two different Diksha Gurus. You don't enroll more than once. The only reason to take a mantra again is if your first Diksha Guru was not a Vaishnava. There's only one verse anywhere that says about taking mantra again, and it says that if the guru is not a Vaishnava, then you need to take the mantra again, because a mantra received from a non-Vaishnava will send you to hell. So there's only one place. It's quoted in many places, but there's only one place. There's other instructions that if any guru, Siksha or Diksha, becomes fallen, that one should respect them from a distance and take Siksha elsewhere. I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been involved in some discussions on guru. And I was thinking, why in ISKCON have we elevated the post of Diksha Guru some billions of times over Siksha Guru? And we've almost made the Diksha Guru in ISKCON a hierarchical, managerial post. You know, it's like you have temple presidents and GBC and Diksha Gurus. And why have we done that? And I thought it's a very practical reason. We've done it because when you get Diksha, you're an enrolled member. And we're an institution. You then become a member of the institution. Are you initiated? You know, of course you can get fooled because kids growing up in the movement or Indians may have Krishna conscious names without being initiated. I went with my son to a temple recently. He says, "Oh, I'm Keshava." And they say, "Oh, who's your guru?" He says, no, I'm not initiated. I was born in the movement. But generally, we tell by the person's name, you know, are they a full member? And we accord privileges and services depending, you know, there's certain services you can only do if you're first initiated, certain services you can only do if you're second initiated. So there's, just like in a school, you know, if you're a student, you can do things in the library and stuff that a non-enrolled student cannot do. Isn't it? You know, once I graduated from the university, all of a sudden I didn't have the same library privileges. It was really a fry. I couldn't access the electronic resources anymore. And the same before you enrolled, you know, you can't. So there's privileges. And because we're an institution that gives these sort of privileges, we've put a lot of stress on the person who says, yes, you're qualified to receive those privileges. But really, your connection with the parampara could be as much or more through Siksha than through Diksha. Because that's our line. And really, the person who gives you Siksha is, in most cases, the most important guru, who may be the same as the person who gives you Diksha, but the person who enrolled, you know, your admissions officer in the university may not be a very important person in your education. They may be, they may not be. Does that make sense? And by the way, before the time of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, it was often like that. That the person who gave Diksha was not a very important person in someone's spiritual life. That was often the case. Therefore, they just gave Diksha. And they didn't go on guiding and giving Siksha to the disciple. So that coming together, more of the two functions, was something that's happened more recently. But I think a lot of us are looking at the way things have kind of evolved in ISKCON, and out of some institutional necessity, we've started to deviate from the Shastric understanding of guru, and it's something that's concerning a lot of us very much. Because if we've institutionalized something that the Shastra says is an offense, then that's we have a problem. And I think we have a serious problem. So that we label, you know, this person is a Diksha Guru. And we don't say, this person is a Siksha Guru. It's become like a title. And we also have created where someone who gives Diksha is accorded more respect by the society in general. And that's also not tradition. So, you know, your husband, you give your husband more respect than you give to other men. But it's not that everybody in the world, just because he's your husband, is going to give him more respect. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you know what I'm saying? So the fact that someone is a teacher or that someone is an admissions officer doesn't mean that automatically they have a certain position. Now, of course, somebody who's an admissions officer in a university has to be somebody who really understands the aim of the university and really understands what qualifications are necessary for students. Because they're a very important gatekeeper. If somebody allows unqualified persons to be enrolled in an institution or blocks qualified persons from coming in, then both the students and the institution are harmed. So the Diksha Guru does have a very responsible role, certainly a role that's more responsible than many others in our movement. But I'd say the Shiksha Guru also has an equally, if not more important role. The Shiksha Gurus are your academic advisors and your professors. Is that all right? I was actually just meditating this morning on how, because I don't know if you know, I'm on the Shastric Advisory Council to the GBC, and one of the main questions that the GBC's asked us to investigate over the years has been the role of guru and how people choose guru and what's the mechanism. So I've been involved with some of the most extensive research on the topic, and I can definitely say that the way things are not the way things should be. And how to get from here to there is not, it's not an easy answer. And there's a lot of divergent opinions. I think we all have the same goal, but how to get there is not clear. It really isn't clear. So hopefully it will become clear. But I hoped I helped you and not confused you.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean with this, how people see the difference between Shiksha and Diksha?
Well, generally what I see in ISKCON is that we don't introduce people as Shiksha Gurus. We don't give people a title of a Shiksha Guru. We don't say, here's Krishna Das, who's a Shiksha Guru. Mm-hmm. We often don't formalize a relationship. A person can say, oh, I accept you as my Shiksha Guru, now I don't accept you as my Shiksha Guru anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't often understand what it means. A person is unlikely, when asked who is your guru, to give the name of their Shiksha Guru. In some cases, they will. I know of some cases where devotees have just a formal relationship with their Diksha Guru and a very strong relationship with the Shiksha Guru. And if you ask them, who's your guru, they'll give the name of their Shiksha Guru. So I know of some instances like that. Or some will they'll give both. But generally, if people are asked, who's your guru, they'll give the name of their Diksha Guru, even if their relationship with their Diksha Guru is almost non-existent. And their main relationship was with the Shiksha Guru. So we tend to think of the Diksha Guru as the guru for everybody, which may not be the case. Do you understand? I'm thinking of one very prominent devotee in our movement whose relationship with his Diksha Guru, who's a wonderful devotee, is almost non-existent. It's the bare minimum formality. And his main relationship is with his Shiksha Guru. In fact, my guess is that probably almost everybody assumes that his Shiksha Guru is his Diksha Guru. He travels with his Shiksha Guru. He does programs with his Shiksha Guru. He calls his Shiksha Guru Guru Dave. His relationship is with his Shiksha Guru. And again, I would assume most people would assume that. But in general, when we ask who's your guru, we're meaning who's your Diksha Guru. And people are they have that mood. And the other difference I pointed out is that we have tended to put the Diksha Gurus in an administrative hierarchical position, in a position of institutional power, which we don't do for Shiksha Gurus. Does that make sense? So we've made those differences. No. Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was initiated by Bipin Bihari.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur.
It's Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And we hear practically nothing about Bhaktivinoda Thakura's Diksha Guru. He had very little relationship with his Diksha Guru. If you do find Bhaktivinoda Thakura in his songs, often sings about Janava Devi. So Janava Devi is in his line of Diksha Guru. But why don't we have Janava's name in our Guru Parampara that's in the Bhagavad Gita? You don't find Bipin Bihari's name, and you don't find Janava's name. Why? We're not listing a Diksha line. We're listing a Shiksha line. And there's a number of other examples that I can't think of right off the top of my head. One is Rupa Goswami also was initiated by someone else, but we put him. Prabhupada said he was a direct disciple of Lord Chaitanya. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't give him Diksha. He gave him Shiksha. The Prabhupada says he was a direct disciple of Lord Chaitanya. And Prabhupada will often use the word disciple to describe a Shiksha relationship, not a Diksha relationship. Again, the analogy is there. The person who enrolls you in a university may be your main academic advisor, or may not be. They may be, they may not be. Their role is essential. And if somebody wants to know, how are you an official member of the institution? You just have to say, well, so-and-so admitted me. Who let you in? Ah, so there you're running into another problem about understanding the difference between Shiksha and Guru, Shiksha and Diksha Guru, in terms of, again, the differences in terms of function. And that is that the word Shiksha Guru can also be applied in a very broad way. So you can say that anybody from whom I learn anything is acting as a kind of Shiksha Guru, and therefore every single living entity can be a kind of Shiksha Guru. I can learn something, I should learn something from the ordinary person on the street. I may even learn what not to do, but I can learn something. I've been to some Bhagavatam classes where that was the only thing I learned was what not to do. So in that sense, but there's different senses in which the same word is used, and that also makes things very confusing. No. The idea of one Diksha Guru is you don't receive the same mantra from more than one person. If someone's enrolled you in the university, you don't then apply and ask someone else to enroll you in the university. You only receive your mantra. You can receive a different mantra from a different guru, but you can't receive the same mantra from more than one guru. That's forbidden. So, for example, you could get the Hare Krishna mantra from one guru, and you could get the Gayatri mantra from another guru. Now, in ISKCON, that only happens if your first guru has fallen or has left their body. But in tradition, that wasn't always the case. In tradition, you sometimes might get one mantra from one guru, and that guru might even say, go to so-and-so and learn this other mantra from them. Now, in ISKCON, we do that, although we don't call it Diksha, but we could. We do that in terms of like getting mantras for deity worship. You may get that from a different person. That's also a kind of Diksha. We read in the Shastra about a so-and-so king will be initiated into the sacrifice and given the mantras for the sacrifice. So if someone's giving you mantras for worship, they're acting as a Diksha Guru, just by the way, actually. So in that sense, you don't have more than one. But Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Tadvadi Pranipasthena, Pariparshthena Sevaya, Upadekshanti Te Ganam, Ganinas Tatvadarshina. That's plural. It's not singular. Vandeham Sri Gurun, that's plural, not singular. I mean, as soon as you accept the Parampara, all of the former gurus are also now your gurus. So Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati is also my guru, as is Bhakti Vinoda, as is Narada Muni, as is Rupa Goswami. Right? When you enroll in a university, there's lots of professors. It's not just one. but you probably have an academic advisor. Generally, you have one main person who really connects you to the university. I mean, it would be awfully confusing if you had, you know, 10 of them who are overseeing your whole program. So it's helpful if there's, but that's not a question of chastity. But it's helpful if there's one person, one main person who's overseeing your program. That's just reasonable. I mean, that's just a practical thing. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you go to a class by a professor and you say, I'm sorry, I can't listen to you because I have to be chased to my academic advisor. You know, I can only take instructions from them. Now, on certain things, you know, just like you might, I started out in just a master's program, then they switched me to the PhD program. So I was getting both my master's and PhD at once. And I was, in each program, I was required to take certain electives. And I'd already taken the ones for the master's. And I asked some of my professors, I said, can those be applied to my PhD program? And they said, I don't think so. Some of them said yes, some of them said no. And there was, again, there was a decider. As I was talking about group and one, there was some ultimate decider. There was the head of the department who decided, yes, we're going to count them, thank God, or I would have had to go an extra semester. So there are certain questions where you're going to have some decider. That's practical. You can't have five different people having authority over the same jurisdiction, but that's not a question of chastity. It's not that when I'm in my economics class, I can't learn something from my economics professor, or that I have to check everything out with my academic advisor. Okay, this is what we learned in class today, you know. The idea is that all the professors and everybody have been certified by the institution and are working in the institution. And if somebody starts saying something that's off, then you go to the proper authorities and you say, hey, you know, this person is teaching communism. Whatever. You know, my economics teacher is teaching a debunked economic theory. You understand? And then the school has to take some measures. So if you find that somebody in the Krishna consciousness movement is teaching bogus philosophy, or they're not following the process, whether they're a Diksha Guru, a Shiksha Guru, town president, whatever, if they're representing the society, then you have to go to the managers of the institution and say, hey, you know, Krishna Dasi's off here. And then they try to rectify it. If they can't rectify it, then they say, you know, this person is not a bona fide teacher. Is that okay? These discussions happen at very high levels in our movement, by the way. It's not just that they happen here in Gauri Yoga Loft in Wellington. These sort of discussions are happening among the top leaders of our movement over and over again. How are we going to manage a worldwide institution that has certain institutional concerns and be totally faithful to the understanding of Diksha and Shiksha Guru given in the Shastra and given by Srila Prabhupada? Oh my. Probably not in the amount of time we have for me to get to the engagement party. What I will recommend to you is Shiva Ram Maharaj gave a talk on this exact topic. Now what I'm doing right now is often done in the Shastra. Mm-hmm. Do you know that? That A will ask B a question and B will say, oh, C asked D that question before. Right? Okay. That exact topic was discussed by Shiva Ram Swami just recently in Mayapur during the GBC meetings. And you can find, I'm pretty sure on dundavats.com there's a transcript of his talk, and I'm pretty sure on his site you can find the audio recording of his talk. Okay? It was a verse in purport where Prabhupada was saying that one should say yes, sir, to the spiritual master. And he gave a very nice explanation of what does that mean. And I think he gave, first of all, a much better explanation than I could give, and second of all, I don't really have the time to get into that. So, all right? So I think, yes?
I just
Of course.
What was Prabhupada's comments about women taking disciples?
He said he wanted it. There's one letter where Prabhupada said that when he was instituting Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, like that, he said, so we're going to have Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, and Bhakti Vedanta. And he said, I think that by 1975, any of my students who have the Bhakti Vedanta title can initiate disciples. He said, I want all my spiritual sons and daughters to inherit the title of Bhakti Vedanta and to initiate disciples. I think that's pretty clear. He said, I want, not they can. It's okay. It's a concession. He said, I want. And then that's the clearest. I mean, that's the most crystal clear. And then there was a lecture given in Mayapur. It was in Mayapur, maybe not. Anyway, it was on Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja Day. And Prabhupada was speaking specifically about disciplic succession. And the reason I say that is that Prabhupada in the lecture wasn't differentiating between Diksha and Shiksha. He was speaking about gurus in general. But he said there also specifically, you know, I want both the boys and girls to become guru. And the context of the lecture was in the context of continuing the parampara and on Vyas Puja Day. So those are the two clearest. There's also, in a general sense, and this is important because Srila Prabhupada said you can only become guru on the order of your guru. And Prabhupada gave his own order as being Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati telling him to preach. I don't know of any instance where Prabhupada said, Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati told me to give diksha to people. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati told me to preach, and he took that, I have the order of my guru to become a guru, and he understood that as meaning giving both diksha and shiksha. And Prabhupada was talking about how women were preachers, and he said that in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, that was often not the case, that often the women were staying at home and the men were going out and preaching, although there certainly were women preaching in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, and there were women giving both diksha and shiksha. And he said, I'm not getting the words exactly right, but I have the quote, I could show you very easily. He was saying, you know, now we're seeing that the men and women are going together to preaching. He was talking primarily about grahastha couples, but he was saying the men and women are both going out and preaching. And there's at least two places where he said, I want to show this example that Krishna consciousness is not limited by any material condition. I want to show this example that women are preachers. So I hear many times from devotees that Prabhupada just made a concession to Western women, that Prabhupada's comments like that, and my conclusion is absolutely not. That part of Prabhupada's mission, and I hear this especially about women's roles in service in India. I hear that, well, Prabhupada didn't want women doing this and that service because he didn't want to rock the boat of people's social conventions in India. But Prabhupada did sometimes do things so as to pacify certain people in India. But we find in general, I mean, it was rocking the boat to have Westerners on the altar offering artik, frankly. That was a big rocking of the boat. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati did that too. He went on parikram in Vrindavan with people to whom he'd given Brahmin initiation who were not born in Brahmin families, and the shopkeepers closed their doors and people were throwing rocks at them. So this shaking up of this idea that spiritual life is dependent on body was something that Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada very much wanted to do. It wasn't some kind of a concession. And Prabhupada wanted us to show that there were preachers and gurus who were Indian, European, African, Chinese, black, white, male, female. He wanted that. He wanted that as an example. And of course we have to become qualified. It's not that Prabhupada just wants somebody to be a preacher and a guru because they are Chinese or because they're a woman. You know, he wants us actually to be mature and Brahmanistam. But it's our duty to become mature and Brahmanistam. If we really want to please Srila Prabhupada, it's our duty to become enlightened beings, to become qualified to be guru, whether we function as Diksha or Shiksha guru or both or whatever. That's our duty to him. So he very much wanted it. And if you hear some annoyance in my voice, it's because I'm annoyed at people who say things like this was some concession to Western people or Western women. I mean, that's not the language that Prabhupada used. He said, this is what I want. I think in one of those places he says, this is my mission, to show that there's no bar for taking up Krishna consciousness. So when I read things like that, then I feel that I have something to offer because I have a Western woman body. That if I can actually become a devotee, then I'll help fulfill Prabhupada's mission of showing that devotional service is not restricted on the basis of the body. And so something which may appear to be an impediment becomes an instrument for service. As Prabhupada says, that Krishna turns all your material impediments into spiritual service. All right? So anyway, if I sound a little revolutionary on this, I am. And if I sound a little upset about it, I am. Those emotions are very real. It's something that's been a source of pain for me for a very long time. And especially when people preach like that in the name of faithfulness to Prabhupada. And branding as anyone who says something different as being a liberal. Right? It's very painful. You know, well, if you say that women should be preachers and gurus, you're a liberal. Ooh. Feels like somebody put a dart in my heart. You know. All right? Hopefully I haven't missed the whole part.